When we talk about Western civilization, to what extent are we talking about a straight line development from classical Greece and Rome through to the present day? Well, our next guest, Michael Warby, says that while there are certainly links, the truly direct connections are actually very limited. Michael Warby, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Now, Michael, Paul Comrie Thompson here. When did this idea that we owe everything to Greece and Rome begin?
A long time after the fall of the Roman Empire. Basically, it's an idea that becomes dominant when classics become what an educated person has as the basis of his repertoire. And it builds slowly, but by the 18th century, people are absolutely convinced that it's, you know, it all ultimately arose in Greece and Rome, and the Dark Ages and the medieval period were a period of appalling ignorance and barbarism, and had nothing really useful to contribute. That's, you know, putting it a little bit high, but not very much. And so it's the 18th century, which really that whole idea that's a nice straight line development gels.
Michael, we had a philosopher named Jim Franklin on the program a while ago, and he pointed out that from the Renaissance on, some people quite deliberately set out to discredit the medieval period. They invented myths such as the chastity belt.
Oh, yes, that was very strong. I mean, and that actually starts quite early. Petrarch in the 14th century is already casting himself as somebody who can see the darkness that we are emerging from, and he's one of these figures who's leading us into the light of true knowledge like they had in the classical era. But he has at least a sense, because he's still in the 14th century, that there is something different behind him. By the 18th, and with the build-up of all these myths, by the 18th century, there's a real problem with getting a view of how big the discontinuity had been after the fall of Rome.
Yeah,
I mean, the Dark Ages are called the Dark Ages because there's very little written material from there. So that's why they're called the Dark Ages.
It's almost like a child growing up and rebelling against the parents, isn't it? I'm thinking about Petrarch with those people in.
Yes.
Michael, it is assumed in popular history that democratic parliament started in Greece. What say you, sir?
That's a very nice myth. It's perfectly true that the word democracy comes from the Greek, demos kratos. But demos didn't mean all the people, it meant the free poor. And if you gave all free adult males, the vote, obviously the free poor had the numbers, so they had the authority, the kratos, so it's a democracy in that sense. But it was a very, very different vision of democracy than the one we have now. And also, it's one that died. I mean, the Athenian democracy died. There are centuries when there was nothing even vaguely democratic about how things were run in the empire and in the early Dark Ages. Our parliaments descend from Germanic warrior assemblies. So that's where they come from, in origins.
Tell us more about this interesting idea.
If you get, it was traditional for Germanic kings. Like, take Big Karl, Charlemagne, king of the Franks, who becomes the first Western emperor, the Imperator Romanus. He was, as a good Frankish monarch, what he would do is every year he'd get all these notables together, the nobles and the bishops, and they would discuss how things are going and who he was going to attack next year and so forth. So he would get these people together, but they were here. In fact, they were there essentially as personal right, because they were a noble, because they were a bishop, and they were held to speak for those who were beholden to them. And it's from this that you begin to get the development eventually of a representative principle, because in the late 12th and early 13th century, Alfonso the Ninth of Leon had a tax problem. His father had been a bit on the profligate side, and it, you know, it's a story we're familiar with. The previous administration has really debauched the
hole.
Yes, exactly. And we've got to do something about this. And one of the things he had to do is raise taxes, but his position was a little bit weak. So what he did is he got the normal notables, the normal nobles and bishops together, but by this stage trade is beginning to revive and the merchants are becoming more important, and they're actually going to bear the burden of a lot of the taxes. You can't get all the merchants there. So what he did is he said to the cities, right, you get your free citizens together, you elect some representatives, and you come to the Cortes as well. And that's when you begin to get the representative principle. Now, about 60 years later, a little bit more than that, Simon de Montfort, when he's having his fight with Henry III's government, wants to base his opposition on something more than, you know, I don't agree. So he calls a parliament, which had plenty of parliaments, but he adds a new element to it. And he does the Alfonso trick. He gets the merchants to send people from their boroughs, and he gets the knights to elect two knights from each shire. So you've got some people are there from personal right, the nobles and the bishops, and you've got some people who are there because they've been elected, the knights and the burgesses from the boroughs, the merchants. And, of course, the elected folk eventually become the House of Commons, and the people who are there by personal right become the House of Lords. It's got nothing to do with the Senate or the Roman Senate or the Athenian assemblies.
And you've made the interesting point in a post on your blog, and we'll put an address on our website, by the way, for our listeners who want to know more, that the Tacitus, many years before the events of which you've just spoken, was pointing out the democracy of the Germans.
Yes.
So it goes back a long way.
Yeah, because originally they're fairly small societies, and if you're fairly small societies, you can get all the free men together. That's what happened in Greece, for example. You can get all the free men together in one place, and you can have basically have a confab. And in the situation where you don't have a lot of administrative capacity, it's a lot easier to get things done if you've got people to agree in the first place.
But this sounds like a much longer democratic tradition than anything that happened in Greece. So it is curious that we don't know more about it.
They didn't write a lot. We got all those Greek texts. I mean, how we got the Greek texts is a very interesting story. But we're relying on Tacitus telling us what the Germans did. We're not relying on the Germans telling us what they did.
Yeah. History belongs to the literate, and I think is what you're saying.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But Michael, one thing that is interesting, we put a classical gloss on many of our institutions and things. For example, the term Senate.
Mm.
Is that an accurate description of what we've got in terms of its origins?
Not really, no. But, of course, once you've got lots of people with classical background, if you're going to have a house of some status, you call it the Senate. Now, this tradition goes back a long way. I mean, Rome had a Senate more or less continually. Its status was variable, let us say. But when the Venetians were setting up their system in the 9th century, they decided, well, we've got to have a Senate. And, you know, when Tsarist Russia is setting up its system, it has a Senate. Now, as it happens, the Tsarist Senate was much more like the original one because no one there was elected. They were all appointed by the Tsar. The original Senate, of course, no one was elected to represent anybody. They were there as personal right. You know, they were elected by the other senators. But, you know, when you get to the American Revolution, they want to give themselves, you know, grand classical illusions. So, of course, you have the House of the upper house is the Senate. Now, the lower house is the House of Representatives, which has nothing classical about it whatsoever. And, it's, you know, it comes obviously out of the House of Commons tradition. But, you know, the classical bug is, you know, big in Washington. I haven't been there, but I've seen the pictures, and there are all lots of neoclassical architecture in Washington.
Michael, and that is kind of funny after what you've told us. What about, we're often told that much Greek philosophy and science was lost and came back to the West in the Renaissance via Arabic works. Is that at least true?
Well, it depends on which Renaissance. The discovery of Greek thought really gets underway in the 11th and the 12th century, and that comes via Arabic work. So you've got a situation where you've got people in Latin Christendom in Western Europe are reading Latin translations of Arabic translations, of Syriac translations of Greek works. Now, that was obviously not terribly satisfactory. So Willem van Moerbach, who was a Dutchman who was bishop of Corinth in Latin bishop, we would say Catholic bishop of Corinth in Greece, translated a whole lot of Greek works into Latin. The tradition is he did it because Thomas Aquinas asked him to, because Thomas wanted, you know, Thomas himself basically only had Latin. He didn't have much Greek. And he wanted something that wasn't a Latin translation of an Arabic translation of a Syriac translation of a Greek text.
But are we pretty much getting the Greek originals at the end of the day there? I mean, were they reintroduced?
Eventually, yes. Yes. Okay. Willem van Moerbach then went to the Greek texts and did a whole lot of translations, some of which are now the only sources for those original texts because the original texts are lost. And then in the 15th century, when the final call of Constantinople, you get all these Greek scholars head west, and then there's a whole surge of more Greek translations which help fuel the Renaissance. But the idea that there's a continuous tradition is greatly exaggerated. I mean, the first.
Yeah, I don't think many people would regard. I think most people would be familiar with that particular diversion you talked with there.
But Michael, on continuity, I'll throw a phrase at you that isn't used so much now, but was until very recently. The Holy Roman Catholic Church is disconnected from classical Rome, you wish to say?
Well, that's a very interesting and mixed thing. I mean, Hobbes famously characterised the papacy as the ghost of the Roman Empire sitting crowned on the grave thereof. The church, of course, does actually come out of the Roman Empire, and the church is the thing that provides the most continuity. And the fact that, for example, Augustine was a Neoplatonist, very deeply influenced by natural law thinking, as a lot of the early fathers were, meant that that strain of natural law thinking, which was incorporated in Christian theology, kept going. But it was a pretty weak strain. There was very little Aristotle known at that stage. But the church did provide continuity, but the church is Christian. And that is the Christianization of the late empire is really a profound profound change in moral sentiment, in metaphysical outlook. I mean, once you get that Christianization, it's very hard to say, well, this is like classical Greece and Rome, because in so many ways, it's just not.
Michael, we're almost out of time there, but this is very interesting stuff, and I'm in particular going to go back and look at those Germans. I always knew there was more to them than we thought. Michael Warby, thanks for joining us today. Michael teaches medieval history and other history in schools in Victoria, and we shall put his address of his blog site on the Counterpoint website, and he was speaking to us there from our Melbourne studio.